Chapter 6 Evaluation. It took a lot to crowd Andrews Air Force Base, whose expansive concrete ramps looked to be the approximate size of Nebraska. But the security police force there was now patrolling a collection of aircraft as dense and as diverse as the place in Arizona where they kept out-of-work airliners. Moreover, each bird had its own security detail, all of whom had to be coordinated with the Americans in an atmosphere of institutional distrust, since the security people were all trained to regard everyone in sight with suspicion. There were two Concords, one British and one French, for sex appeal. The rest were mainly wide bodies of one sort or another, and most of them liveried in the colors of the nation flag carrier of their country of origin. Sabena, KLM, and Lufthansa led off the NATO row. SAS handled each of the three Scandinavian countries, each with its own 747.
Chiefs of state traveled in style, and not one of the aircraft, large or small, had flown as much as a third full. Greeting them was a task to tax the skills and patience of the combined White House and State Department offices of protocol, and word was sent through the embassies that President Ryan simply didn't have the time to give everyone the attention he or she deserved. But the Air Force Honor Guard got to meet them all, forming, dismissing, and reforming more than once an hour while the red VIP carpet stayed in place. And one world leader followed another. At times, as quickly as one aircraft could be rolled to its parking place, and another could taxi to the specified arrival point with band and podium. Speeches were kept brief and somber for the ranks of cameras, and then they were moved off briskly to the waiting ranks of cars. Moving them into Washington was yet another headache. Every car belonging to the Diplomatic Protection Service was tied up, forming four sets of escorts that hustled in and out of town, convoying the embassy limousines and tying up Suitland Parkway and Interstate 395. The most amazing part, perhaps, was that every president, prime minister, and even the kings and serene princes managed to get delivered to the proper embassy, most of them, fortunately, on Massachusetts Avenue. It proved to be a triumph of improvised organization in the end. The embassies themselves handled the quiet private receptions. The statesmen, all in one place, had to meet, of course, to do business or merely to chat. The British ambassador, the most senior of both the NATO countries and his nation's commonwealth, would this night host an informal dinner for 22 national leaders. "Okay, his gear is down this time," the Air Force captain said, as darkness fell on the base. The tower crew at Andrews was, perversely, the same one which had been on duty on that night, as people had taken to call it. They watched as the JAL 747 floated in on runway 01 right. The flight crew might have noticed that the remains of a sister aircraft were to be found in a large hangar on the east side of the base. At this moment, a truck was delivering the distorted remains of a jet engine, recently extracted from the basement of the Capitol building. But the jetliner completed its rollout, following directions to turn left and taxi behind a vehicle to the proper place for deplaning its passengers. The pilot did notice the cameras, and the crewmen walking from the relative warmth of a building to their equipment for the latest and most interesting arrival. He thought to say something to his co-pilot, but decided not to. Captain Torajiro Sato had been, well, if not a close friend, then a colleague, and a cordial one at that. And the disgrace to his country, his airline, and his profession would be a difficult thing to bear for years. It could only have been worse had Sato been carrying passengers, for protecting them was the first rule of their lives. But even though his culture respected suicide for a purpose as an honorable exercise, and beyond that awarded status to the more dramatic exits from corporeal life, this example of it had shocked and distressed his country more than anything in living memory. The pilot had always worn his uniform with pride. Now he would change out of it at the earliest opportunity, both abroad and at home. The pilot shook off the thought, applied the brake smoothly, and halted the airliner so that the old-fashioned wheeled stairway was exactly even with the forward door of the Boeing airliner. It was then that he and his co-pilot turned inward to share a look of irony and shame at having performed their job with skill. Instead of sleeping over at the usual mid-level Washington hotel, they would be quartered in officers' accommodations on the base, and, probably, with someone to watch over them. With a gun. The door of the airliner opened under the gentle ministrations of the senior stewardess. Prime Minister Mogotaru Koga, his coat buttoned and his tie straightened in his collar by a flustered aide, stood in the door briefly, assaulted by a blast of cold February air, and headed down the steps. The Air Force band struck up Ruffles and Flourishes. Acting Secretary of State Scott Adler was waiting at the bottom. The two had never met, but both had been fully briefed, Adler rather more quickly, as this was his fourth and most important arrival of the day. Koga looked just like his pictures. The man was grossly ordinary, about 5 feet 6 inches in height, of middle age, with a full head of black hair. His dark eyes were neutral, or tried to be, Adler thought on closer examination. There was sadness there. Hardly a surprise, the diplomat thought as he extended his hand. "Welcome, Mr. Prime Minister."
"Thank you, Mr. Adler."
The two men walked to the podium. Adler spoke a few muted words of welcome. This speech, drafted at Foggy Bottom, had taken an hour to get right, which amounted to about a minute to the world. Then Koga came to the microphone.
"First of all, I must thank you, Mr. Adler, and thank your country for allowing me to come today. As surprising as this gesture is, I have come to understand that such things are a tradition in your vast and generous country. I come to represent my country today on a sad but necessary mission. I hope it will be a mission of healing for your country and for mine. I hope that your citizens and ours can see in this tragedy a bridge to a peaceful future."
Koga stepped back, and Adler led him off down the red carpet, as the assembled band played Kimigayo, the brief anthem of Japan which had actually been written by an English composer 100 years earlier. The Prime Minister looked at the honor guard and tried to read the young faces, looking for hatred or disgust in them, but finding only impassivity on the way to the waiting car, Adler got in behind him.
"How are you feeling, sir?" Sexstate asked.
"Well, thank you. I slept on the flight."
Koga assumed that the question was a mere pleasantry, then learned that it was not. It had been Ryan's idea, not Adler's, oddly enough, made somewhat more convenient by the time of day. The sun was down below the horizon now, and the sunset would be a brief one, as clouds rolled in from the northwest.
"If you wish, we can see President Ryan on the way to your embassy. The President instructed me to say that if you would prefer not to do so because of the lengthy flight or other reasons, he will not be offended."
Scott was surprised that Koga didn't hesitate an instant.
"I gladly accept this honor."
The acting Secretary of State pulled a portable radio from his coat pocket. "Eagle to Sword Base, affirmative." Adler had chuckled a few days earlier to learn his Secret Service code name. Eagle was the English counterpart to his German-Jewish surname. "Sword Base copies affirmative," the encrypted radio crackled back. "Eagle out." The motorcade speeded up Suitland Parkway. Under other circumstances, a news helicopter might have tracked them with a live camera, but Washington airspace was effectively shut down for the moment. Even National Airport was closed, with its flights shunted to Dulles or Baltimore-Washington International. Koga hadn't noticed the driver, who was American. The car turned right off the parkway, then hopped a block to the ramp for I-295, which turned almost immediately into I-395, a bumpy thoroughfare that led across the Anacostia River toward downtown Washington. As it merged with the main roadway, the stretch Lexus in which he was sitting veered to the right. Another identical car took its place as his formed up with three Secret Service Suburbans in a maneuver that took a mere 5 seconds. The empty streets made the rest of the trip easy, and in but a few minutes his car turned onto West Executive Drive.
"Here they come, sir," Price said, notified by the uniformed guard at the gatehouse.
Jack walked outside just as the car halted, not sure of the protocol for this. One more thing he'd yet to figure out about his new job. He almost moved to pull open the door himself, but a Marine corporal got there first, yanking the door and saluting like a robot.
"Mr. President," Koga said on standing up.
"Mr. Prime Minister, please come this way."
Ryan gestured with his hand.
Koga had never been to the White House before, and it struck him that had he flown over,
what, 3 months earlier, to discuss the trade problems that had led to a shooting war, yet another shameful failure.
Then Ryan's demeanor came through the haze. He'd read once that the full ceremonies of a state arrival were not the sign of importance here. Well, that was not possible or appropriate in any case, Koga told himself. But Ryan had stood alone at the door, and that must have meant something, the Japanese Prime Minister told himself on the way up the stairs. A minute later, whizzed through the West Wing, he and Ryan were alone in the Oval Office, separated only by a low table and a coffee tray.
"Thank you for this," Koga said simply.
"We had to meet," President Ryan said.
"Any other time and we'd have people watching and timing us and trying to read our lips."
He poured a cup for his guest and then himself.
"Aye, the press in Tokyo have become much more forward in the past few days."
Koga made to lift his cup, but stopped.
"Whom do I thank for rescuing me from Yamata?"
Jack looked up.
"The decision was made here. The two officers are in the area, if you want to see them again personally."
"If it is convenient."
Koga sipped at his cup. He would have preferred tea, but Ryan was doing his best to be a host, and the quality of the gesture impressed his guest.
"Thank you for letting me come, President Ryan."
"I tried to talk to Roger about the trade problem, but I wasn't persuasive enough. Then I worried that something might be happening with Goto, but I didn't move quickly enough, what with the Russian trip and everything. It was all a great big accident, but I suppose war usually is. In any case, it is up to the two of us to heal that wound. I want it done as rapidly as possible."
"The conspirators are all under arrest. They will appear in court for treason," Koga promised.
"That is your affair," the president replied. Which wasn't really true. Japan's legal system was a curious one, in which courts often enough violated the country's constitution in favor of broader but unwritten cultural mores, something unthinkable to Americans. Ryan and America expected that the trials would go by the book with no such variations. Koga understood that fully. A reconciliation between America and Japan depended absolutely on that, along with a multitude of other understandings which could not be spoken, at least not at this level. For his own part, Koga had already made sure that the judges selected for the various trials understood what the rules were.
"I never thought it possible that such a thing could happen, and then, that madman Sato. My country and my people are shamed by it. I have so much to do, Mr. Ryan."
Jack nodded.
"We both do. But it will be done."
He paused. "The technical issues can be handled at the ministerial level. Between ourselves, I only wanted to be sure that we understood each other. I will trust your goodwill."
"Thank you, Mr. President."
Koga set his cup down to examine the man on the opposite sofa. He was young for such a job, though not the youngest American president. Theodore Roosevelt would probably hold that distinction into eternity. On the lengthy flight from Tokyo, he'd read up on John Patrick Ryan. The man had killed with his own hand more than once, had been threatened with his own death and that of his family, and had done other things which his intelligence advisers only speculated about. Examining his face over a brief span of seconds, he tried to understand how such a person could also be a man of peace. But the clues were not there to be seen, and Koga wondered if there was something in the American character that he'd never quite understood. He saw the intelligence and the curiosity, one to measure and the other to probe. He saw fatigue and sadness. His recent days must have been the purest form of hell, Koga was sure. Somewhere still in this building, probably, were the children of Roger and Ann Derling. And that would be like a physical weight for the man to carry about. It struck the Prime Minister that Ryan, like most Westerners, was not very skilled at concealing his inner thoughts. But that wasn't true, was it? There had to be other things happening behind those blue eyes, and those things were not being advertised. They were not in any way threatening, but they were there. This Ryan was samurai, as he'd said in his office a few days earlier. But there was an additional layer of complexity as well. Koga set that aside. It wasn't all that important, and there was something that he had to ask, a personal decision he'd made over Mid-Pacific.
"I have a request, if that is permitted."
"What is that, sir?"
"Mr. President, this is not a good idea," Price objected a few minutes later.
"Good or not, we're going to do it. Get it organized," Ryan told her.
"Yes, sir."
Andrea Price withdrew from the room. Koga watched the exercise and learned something else. Ryan was a man capable of making decisions and giving orders entirely without histrionics. The cars were still at the west entrance, and it was simply a matter of donning coats and getting into them. A total of 4 Suburbans U-turned in the parking area, heading south, then east toward the hill. The motorcade this time didn't use sirens and lights, instead proceeding almost in accord with the traffic laws, but not quite. The empty streets made it easy for them to jump lights, and soon enough they turned left onto Capitol Street, and left again toward the building. There were fewer lights now in evidence. The steps had been cleared, allowing an easy climb up once the cars had parked and the Secret Service agents deployed. Ryan led Koga upwards, and presently they were both looking down into the now empty bowl that had been the House chamber. The Japanese Prime Minister stood erect at first. He clapped his hands loudly, once, to garner the attention of the spirits who, his religious beliefs told him, would still be here. Then he bowed formally and said his prayers for them. Ryan was moved to do the same. There were no TV cameras present to record the moment. Actually, there were still a few network cameras about, but the evening news broadcasts were over, and the instruments stood idle, their crews in the control vans drinking coffee, and unaware of what was taking place 100 yards away. It took only a minute or two in any case. When it was over, an American hand was extended, and a Japanese hand took it, and 2 pairs of eyes came to an understanding that ministers and treaties could never really have achieved, and in the harsh February wind, peace was finally and completely made between 2 countries. Standing 10 feet away, Andrea Price was glad that the White House photographer had come along, and the tears she blinked away from her eyes were not from the wind. Then she conducted the 2 men back down the steps and into separate cars.
"Why did they overreact so?" the Prime Minister asked before sipping her sherry.
"Well, as you know, I have not been fully briefed," the Prince of Wales replied, first qualifying himself, since he didn't really speak for Her Majesty's government. "But your naval exercises did have the appearance of a threatening act."
"Sri Lanka must come to terms with the Tamils. They've shown a regrettable reluctance to enter into substantive negotiations, and we were trying to influence them. After all, we have our own troops deployed as peacekeepers, and we don't want them to be held hostage to the overall situation."
"Quite so, but then,
Why don't you withdraw your peacekeepers as the government requested?
The Indian Prime Minister sighed tiredly. It had been a long flight for her, too, and under the circumstances a little exasperation was permissible.
Your Royal Highness, if we withdraw our troops and then the situation flares up yet again, we will face difficulties with our own Tamil citizens. This is truly a most unhappy situation. We attempted to help assuage a difficult political impasse, entirely at our own expense, but then the Sri Lankan government finds itself unable to take the remedial action necessary to prevent an embarrassment to my country, and a continuing rebellion in their own. Then the Americans interfere without any real cause, and only bolster the intransigence of the Sri Lankans.
"When does their Prime Minister arrive?" the Prince asked. The substantive reply was a shrug, followed by verbiage. "We offered the chance to fly over together so that we might discuss the situation, but he regrettably declined. Tomorrow, I think. If his aircraft doesn't malfunction," she added. That national flag carrier had all manner of technical problems, not to mention a long-lived security threat.
"If you wish, the ambassador can probably arrange a quiet meeting."
"Perhaps that would not be entirely useless," the Prime Minister allowed. "I also wish the Americans would get the proper spin on things. They've always been so hopeless on our part of the world."
Which was the point of the exercise, the Prince understood. He and President Ryan had been friends for years, and India wanted him to be the intercessor. It would hardly have been the first time for such a mission on his part, but in all such cases the heir apparent was constrained to seek guidance from the government, which in this case meant the ambassador. Someone in Whitehall had decided that His Royal Highness's friendship with the new American president was more important than a government-to-government contact, and besides it would make the monarchy look good at a time when such appearances were both useful and necessary. It also gave His Highness an excuse to visit some land in Wyoming which was quietly owned by the royal family, or the firm, as it was sometimes called by insiders.
"I see,"
was as substantive a reply as he could make. But Britain had to take a request from India seriously. Once the brightest diadem in a world-spanning crown, that country was still an important trading partner, bloody nuisance though it might frequently be. A direct contact between the two heads of government might be embarrassing. The American harassment of the Indian fleet was not widely publicized, falling as it had toward the end of hostilities between America and Japan. And it was in everyone's interest that things should remain that way. President Ryan had enough on his plate, his old friend knew. The Prince hoped that Jack was getting some rest. For the people in the reception room, sleep was just a defense against jet lag. For Ryan, it was necessary fuel, and he'd need plenty for the next 2 days. The line was endless, the typical cliché. It stretched well beyond the Treasury building, and the far end of it was like the ragged end of a rope, with new people forming up and tightening into the line so that it appeared to generate itself out of air, constantly replenishing as its members moved slowly forward in the cold air. They entered the building in groups of 50 or so, and the opening-closing cycle of the doors was regulated by someone with a watch, or maybe just counting slowly. There was an honor guard, an enlisted member of each uniformed service. The detail was commanded by an Air Force captain at the moment. They and the caskets stood still while the people shuffled past. Ryan examined their faces on his office TV just after he came in, again before sunrise, wondering what they thought and why they'd come. Few had actually voted for Roger Durling. He'd been the number two man on the ticket after all, and he'd taken over the job only with the resignation of Bob Fowler. But America embraced her presidents, and in death Roger was the recipient of love and respect that had never seemed all that close to him in life. Some of the mourners turned away from the coffins to look around at the entry hall of a building which many had probably never seen before, using their few seconds of time there strangely to look away from the reason for their having come, then to go down the steps and out the east entrance, no longer a line, but in groups of friends or family members, or even alone, to leave the city and do their business. Then it was time for him to do the same, more properly to head back to his family and study up for the tasks of the following day.
Why not? They'd decided on arriving at Dulles.
Lucky enough to find a cheap motel at the end of the metro's yellow line, they'd ridden the subway into town and gotten off at the Farragut Square station, only a few blocks from the White House, so that they could take a look. It would be a first for both of them, many firsts, in fact, since neither had ever visited Washington, the cursed city on a minor river that polluted the entire country from which it sucked blood and treasure. These were favored lines of the mountain men. Finding the end of the line had taken time, and they'd shuffled along for several hours, with the only good news being that they knew how to dress for cold, which was more than they could say for the East Coast idiots in the line with them, with their thin coats and bare heads. It was all Pete Holbrook and Ernest Brown could do to keep from cracking their jokes about what had happened. Instead, they listened to what other people in line said. That turned out to be disappointing. Maybe a lot of them were federal employees, both men thought. There were a few whimpers about how sad it all was, how Roger Durling had been a very nice man, and how attractive his wife had been, and how cute the children were, and how awful it must be for them. Well, the two members of the Mountain Men had to agree between themselves. Yeah, sure enough, it was tough on the kids. And who didn't like kids? But scrambling eggs was probably something Mama Chicken didn't like to see, right? And how much suffering had their father inflicted on honest citizens who only wanted to have their constitutional right to be left alone by all these useless Washington jerks? But they didn't say that. They kept their mouths mostly shut as the line wended its way along the street. Both knew the story of the Treasury Building, which sheltered them from the wind for a while, how Andy Jackson had decided to move it so that he couldn't see the Capitol Building from the White House. It was still too dark for them to make out very much, causing the famous and annoying jog in Pennsylvania Avenue. Not that that mattered any more, since the street had been closed in front of the White House. And why? To protect the president from the citizens. Couldn't trust the citizens to get too close to the grand poobah. They couldn't say that, of course. It was something the two had discussed on the flight in. There was no telling how many government spy types might be around, especially in the line to the White House, a name for the structure they'd accepted only since it had allegedly been selected by Davy Crockett. Holbrook had recalled that from a movie he'd seen on TV, though he couldn't remember which movie, and old Davy was without a doubt their kind of American, a man who'd named his favorite rifle. Yeah. It wasn't really a bad-looking house, and some good men had lived there. Andy Jackson, who'd told the Supreme Court where to get off. Lincoln, a tough old son of a bitch. What a shame he'd been killed before implementing his plan to ship the niggers back to Africa or Latin America. Both rather liked James Monroe as well for starting that idea to help to establish Liberia as a place to ship the slaves back to. A pity that nobody had followed up on it. Teddy Roosevelt, who had a lot of good things going for him, a hunter and outdoorsman and soldier, who'd gone a little far in reforming the government. Not many since, though, both men judged. But it wasn't the building's fault that it had more recently been occupied by people they didn't like. That was the problem with Washington buildings. The Capitol had once been home to Henry Clay and Daniel Webster, after all. Patriots, unlike the bunch who'd been roasted by that Jap pilot. Things got a little bit tense when they turned into the White House grounds, like entering enemy territory. There were guards at the gatehouse of the Secret Service's uniformed division, and inside were Marines.
Wasn't that a shame? Marines. Real Americans, even the colored ones, probably. 'Cause they went through the training same as the white ones, and probably some of them were patriots, too. Too bad they were niggers, but it couldn't be helped. And all the Marines did what they were told by the Krats. That made the looks a little hard to take. They were just kids, though, and maybe they'd learn. After all, the Mountain Men had a few ex-military in it. The Marines were shivering in their long coats and white fairy gloves, and finally one of them, a buck sergeant by the stripes, opened the door. Some house, Holbrook and Brown thought, looking up and around the towering foyer. It was easy to see how somebody who lived here might think himself king shit. You had to watch out for stuff like that. Lincoln had grown up in a log cabin, and Teddy had known life in a tent, hunting up in the mountains. But nowadays whoever lived here was just another damned crat. Inside were more Marines, and the honor guard around the two boxes, and, most disquieting of all, people in civilian clothes with little plastic curly things that led from their suit collars to their ears. Secret Service. Federal cops. The face of the enemy. Members of the same government department that held the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. That figured. The first instance of citizens objecting to the government had been about alcohol, the Whiskey Rebellion, which was why the Mountain Men were equivocal in their admiration for George Washington. The more liberal of them remarked that even a good man can have a bad day, and George wasn't a guy to fuck with. Brown and Holbrook didn't look directly at the Secret Service pukes. You had to be careful fucking with them, too. Special Agent Price walked into the foyer then. Her principal was safe in his office, and her responsibilities as detail commander extended throughout the entire building. The procession wasn't a security threat to the house. In terms of security, it was just a nuisance. Even if a gang of gunmen had secreted itself in the line, behind the closed doors all around this area were 20 armed agents, many of them with Uzi submachine guns in their fast-action gun bags, unkindly known as fag bags. A metal detector hidden in the doorway told a crew from the Technical Security Division whom to look at, and other agents concealed in their hands photos stacked together like a deck of cards, which they shuffled through constantly until every face coming through the door could be compared with known or suspected troublemakers. For the rest, they depended on instincts and training, and that came down to people who looked funny, the usual Americanism for inappropriate demeanor. The problem with that was the cold weather outside. People came in, and a lot of them looked funny. Some stamped their feet a little. Others shoved hands into pockets or adjusted coats or shivered or just looked around oddly, all of which was calculated to attract the attention of somebody on the detail. On those occasions when the gestures came from one who had pinged the metal detector, an agent would raise his or her hand as though scratching one's nose and speak into a microphone. Blue coat, male 6 feet, for example, would cause four or five heads to turn for a closer look at, in that case, a dentist from Richmond who had just switched his pocket hand warmer from one side to the other. His physical dimensions were checked against threat photos of similarly sized subjects and found not to match. But they watched him anyway, and a hidden TV camera zoomed in to record his face. In a few more extreme cases, an agent would join up with the exiting mourners and follow a subject to a car to catch the tag number. The long-since de-established Strategic Air Command had taken as its first official motto, "Peace is our profession." For the Secret Service, the business was paranoia, the necessity for which was made plain by the two caskets in the White House foyer. Brown and Holbrook had their 5 seconds of direct viewing. Two expensive boxes, doubtless purchased at government expense, and blasphemously, they thought, draped with the stars and stripes. Well, maybe not for the wife. After all, the womenfolk were supposed to be loyal to their men, and that couldn't be helped. The flow of the crowd took them to the left, and velvet ropes guided them down the steps. They could feel the change in the others. A collective deep breath, and some sniffles of people wiping away their tears, mainly the womenfolk. The two mountain men stayed impassive, as most of the men did. The Remington sculptures on the way out caused both to stop and admire briefly, and then it was back into the open, and the fresh air was a welcome cleansing after the few minutes of federal steam heat. They didn't speak until they were off the grounds and away from others.
"Nice boxes we bought them," Holbrook managed to say first.
"Shame they weren't open."
Brown looked around. Nobody was close enough to hear his indiscretion.
"They do have kids," Pete pointed out.
He headed south so that they could see down Pennsylvania Avenue.
"Yeah, yeah, yeah, and they'll grow up to be crats, too."
They walked a few more yards.
"Damn."
There was nothing else one could say, except maybe fuck, Holbrook thought, and he didn't like repeating things Ernie said. The sun was coming up, and the absence of tall buildings to the east of the hill meant that the white building was beautifully silhouetted. Though it was the first trip to Washington for both, either man could have done a reasonably accurate sketch of the building from memory, and the wrongness of the horizon could not have been more obvious. Pete was glad that Ernie had talked him into coming. Just the sight made all the travel hassles worth it. This time he managed the first collective thought.
"Ernie," Holbrook said in awe, "it's inspirational."
"Yeah."
One problem with the disease was that the warning signs were equivocal, and her main concern was one of her patients. He was such a nice boy, but he was gravely ill. Sister Jean-Baptiste saw now that his fever had spiked to 40.4 degrees Celsius, and that was deadly enough, but the other signs were worse. The disorientation had gotten worse. The vomiting had increased, and now there was blood in it. There were indications of internal bleeding. All that, she knew, could mean one of several things, but the one she worried about was called Ebola Zaire. There were many diseases in the jungle of this country. She still thought of it occasionally as the Belgian Congo. And while the competition for the absolute worst was stiffer than one might imagine, Ebola was at the bottom of that particular pit. She had to draw blood for another test, and this she did with great care, the first sample having been lost somehow or other. The younger staff here weren't as thorough as they ought. His parents held the arm while she drew the blood, her hand fully protected with latex gloves. It went smoothly. The boy was not even semi-conscious at the moment. She withdrew the needle and placed it immediately in a plastic box for disposal. The blood vial was safe, but that too went into another container. Her immediate concern was the needle. Too many people on staff tried to save money for the hospital by reusing instruments. This, despite AIDS and other diseases communicated by blood products. She'd handle this one herself, just to make sure. She didn't have time to look more at the patient. Leaving the ward, she walked through the breezeway to the next building. The hospital had a long and honorable history, and had been built to allow for local conditions. The many low-frame buildings were connected by covered walkways. The laboratory building was only 50 meters away. This facility was blessed. Recently, the World Health Organization had established a presence here, along with which had come modern equipment and 6 young physicians. But, alas, no nurses. All were British or American trained. Dr. Mohammed Moody was at the lab bench. Tall, thin, swarthy, he was somewhat cold in his demeanor, but he was proficient. He turned as he saw her approach and took note of the way she disposed of the needle.
"What is it, sister?"
"Patient Makusa. Benedict Makusa. African male, age 8.
She handed the paperwork over. Moody opened the folder and scanned it. For the nurse, Christian or not, she was a holy woman and a fine nurse. The symptoms had occurred one at a time. The paper presentation to the physician was far more efficient. Headache, chills, fever, disorientation, agitation, and now signs of an internal bleed. When he looked up, his eyes were guarded. If Petechia appeared on his skin next...
He's in the general ward?
Yes, doctor.
Move him to the isolation building at once. I'll be over there in half an hour.
Yes, doctor.
On the way out, she rubbed her forehead. It must have been the heat. You never really got used to it, not if you came from Northern Europe. Maybe an aspirin after she saw to her patient.
Chapter 7 Public Image.
It started early, when two E-3B Sentry aircraft, which had deployed from Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma to Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina, took off from the latter at 0800 local time and headed north. It had been decided that closing down all the local airports would have been too much. Washington National remained closed, and with no congressmen to race there for a flight to their districts, their special parking lot was well known, it even appeared that the facility might remain that way. And at the other two, Dulles and Baltimore Washington International, controllers were under very precise instructions. Flights in and out were to avoid a bubble more than 20 miles in diameter and centered on the White House. Should any aircraft head toward the bubble, it would instantly be challenged. If the challenge were ignored, it would soon find a fighter aircraft off its wingtip. If that didn't work, the third stage would be obvious and spectacular. Two flights, each of four F-16 fighters, were orbiting the city in relays at an altitude of 18 and 20,000 feet, respectively. The altitude kept the noise down. It also would enable them to tip over and reach supersonic speed almost immediately. But the white contrails made patterns in the blue sky as obvious as those the 8th Air Force had once traced over Germany. About the same time, the 260th Military Police Brigade of the Washington, D.C. National Guard redeployed to maintain traffic control. More than 100 Humvees were in side streets, each with a police or FBI vehicle in close attendance, controlling traffic by blocking the streets. An honor guard assembled from all the services lined the streets to be used. There was no telling which of the rifles might be equipped with a full magazine. Some people had actually expected the security precautions to be kept quiet, because armored vehicles had been dispensed with. There was a total of 61 chiefs of state in the city. The day would be security hell for everyone, and the media made sure that everyone would share the experience. For the last one of these, Jacqueline Kennedy had decided on morning clothes. But 35 years had passed, and dark business suits would now suffice, except for those foreign government officials who wore uniforms of various sorts. The Prince of Wales was a commissioned officer, or visitors from tropical countries. Some of them would wear their national garb, and would suffer the consequences in the name of national dignity. Just getting them around town and into the White House was a nightmare. Then came the problem of how to line them up in the procession. Alphabetically by country? Alphabetically by name? By seniority in office, would have given undue primacy of place to a few dictators who had come to find for themselves some legitimacy in the diplomatic major leagues, bolstering the status of countries and governments with which America had friendly relations, but for which America had little love. They all came to the White House, marching past the coffins after the last of the line of American citizens had been cut off, pausing to pay personal respects, and from there into the East Room, where a platoon of State Department officials struggled to get things organized over coffee and Danish. Ryan and his family were upstairs, putting the finishing touches on their dark clothes, attended by White House staff members. The children handled it the best, accustomed to having Mom and Dad brush their hair on the way out the door, and amused to see Mom and Dad being treated the same way. Jack was holding a copy of his first speech. It was past time for him to close his eyes and wish everything away. Now he felt like a boxer, overmatched by his opponent, but unable to take a dive, taking every punch as best he could and trying not to disgrace himself. Mary Abbott applied the final touches to his hair and locked everything in place with spray, something Ryan had never used voluntarily in his life.
"They're waiting, Mr. President," Arnie said.
"Yeah."
Jack handed the speech binder to one of the Secret Service agents. He headed out of the room, followed by Kathy, who held Katie. Sally took little Jack's hand to follow them into the corridor and down the stairs. President Ryan walked slowly down the square spiral of steps, then turned left to the East Room. As he entered the room, heads turned. Every eye in the room looked at him, but these looks were in no way casual, and few of them were sympathetic. Almost every pair belonged to a chief of state. Those that did not belonged to an ambassador, each of whom would this night draft a report on the new American president. It was Ryan's good fortune that the first to approach him was one who would not need to do anything of the sort. "Mr. President," said the man in the Royal Navy mess jacket. His ambassador had positioned things nicely. On the whole, London rather liked the new arrangement. The special relationship would become more special, as President Ryan was an honorary knight commander of the Victorian Order.
"Your Highness."
Jack paused and allowed himself a smile as he shook the offered hand.
"Long time since that day in London, pal."
"Indeed."
The sun wasn't as warm as it should have been. The wind saw to that, its hard-cast shadows merely making things appear colder. The D.C. police led off with a rank of motorcycles, then three drummers followed by marching soldiers. They were a squad from 3rd Platoon, Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 501st Infantry Regiment, 82nd Airborne, which had once been Roger Durling's own. Then the riderless horse, boots reversed in the stirrups, and the gun carriages, side by side for this funeral, husband and wife. Then the lines of cars. The cold air did one other thing. The drums' brutal thunder echoed sharply up and down the man-made canyons. As the procession headed northwest, the soldiers, sailors, and marines came to present arms, first for the old president, then for the new. Men mainly removed whatever hats they might be wearing. Some forgot, for the former. Brown and Holbrook didn't forget. Durling may just have been another crat, but the flag was the flag, and it wasn't the flag's fault that it was draped there. The soldiers strutted up the street, incongruously wearing battle-dress uniforms with red berets and bloused jump boots, because, the radio commentator said, Roger Durling had been one of their own. Before the gun carriage walked two more soldiers, the first carrying the presidential flag, and the second with a framed plaque which contained Durling's combat decorations. The deceased president had won a medal for rescuing a soldier under fire. That former soldier was somewhere in the procession, and had already been interviewed about a dozen times, soberly recounting the day on which a president-to-be had saved his life. A shame he'd gone wrong, the mountain men reflected, but more likely he'd been a politician the whole time. The new president appeared presently, his automobile identifiable by the four Secret Service agents pacing alongside it. This new one was a mystery to the two mountain men. They knew what they'd seen on TV and read in the papers. A shooter. He'd actually killed two people, one with a pistol and one with an Uzi. Ex-Marine, even. That excited a little admiration. Other TV coverage, repeated again and again, mainly showed him doing Sunday talk shows and briefings. In most of the former, he looked competent. In the latter, he often appeared uncomfortable. Most of the car windows in the procession had the dark plastic coating that prevented people from seeing who rode inside. But not the president's car, of course. His three children sitting ahead of him and facing back from the jump seat, with his wife at his side, President John Ryan was easy to see from the sidewalk.
What do we really know about Mr. Ryan?
Not much, the commentator admitted. His government service has been almost exclusively in CIA. He has the respect of Congress on both sides of the aisle. He's worked with Alan Trent and Sam Fellows for years. That's one of the reasons both members are still alive. We've all heard the story of the terrorists who attacked him.
Like something out of the Wild West, the anchor interjected. What do you think about having a president who's...
killed people? The commentator returned the favor.
He was tired from days of long duty, and just a little tired of this coiffured airhead. Let's see, George Washington was a general, so was Andy Jackson. William Henry Harrison was a soldier. Grant and most of the post-Civil War presidents. Teddy Roosevelt, of course. Truman was a soldier. Eisenhower. Jack Kennedy was in the Navy, as were Nixon and Jimmy Carter and George Bush. The impromptu history lesson had the visual effect of a cattle prod.
But he was selected as vice president really in a caretaker status, wasn't he? And as payback for his handling of the conflict, nobody really called it a war, with what turned out to be Japanese business interests.
There, the anchor thought, that would put this overaged foreign correspondent in his place. Whoever said that a president was entitled to any honeymoon at all, anyway? Ryan wanted to look over his speech, but he found that he couldn't. It was pretty cold out there. It wasn't exactly warm in the car, but thousands of people stood out there in 29-degree air, 5 to 10 deep on the sidewalks, and their faces tracked his car as it passed by. They were close enough that he could see their expressions. Many pointed and said things to the people standing next to them. "There he is. There's the new one." Some waved. Small, embarrassed gestures from people who were unsure if it was okay to do so, but wanting to do something to show that they cared. Moore nodded respect, with the tight smile that you saw in a funeral home. "Hope you'll be okay." Jack wondered if it was proper to wave back, but decided that it wasn't, bound by some unwritten rule that applied to funerals. And so he just looked at them, his face, he thought, in a neutral mien, without saying anything because he didn't know what to say either. Well, he had a speech to handle that, Ryan thought, frustrated with himself.
"Not a happy camper," Brown whispered to Holbrook.
They waited a few minutes for the crowd to loosen up. Not all of the spectators were interested in the procession of foreign dignitaries. You couldn't see into the cars anyway, and keeping track of all the flags that flew on the front bumpers merely started various versions of "which one is that one," often with an incorrect answer. So, like many others, the two mountain men shouldered their way back from the curb into a park.
"He ain't got it," Holbrook replied finally.
"He's just a crat. Remember the Peter Principle?" It was a book which, both thought, had been written to explain government workers. In any hierarchy, people tended to rise to their level of incompetence.
"I think I like this."
His comrade looked back at the street and the cars and the fluttering little flags.
"I think you may be right."
Security at the National Cathedral was airtight. In their hearts, the Secret Service agents knew that, and knew that no assassin—the idea of professional assassins was largely a creation of Hollywood anyway—would risk his life under these circumstances. Every building with a direct line of sight to the Gothic-style church had several policemen or soldiers or USSS special agents atop it, many of them armed with rifles, and their own counter-sniper team armed with the finest of all, $10,000 handmade instruments that could reach more than half a mile and touch someone in the head. The team, which won competition shoots with the regularity of the tides, was probably the best collection of marksmen the world had ever seen, and practiced every day to keep that way. Anyone who wanted to do mischief would either know all these things and stay away, or, in the case of an amateur madman, would see the massive defensive arrangements and decide this wasn't a good day to die. But things were tense anyway, and even as the procession appeared in the distance, agents were hustling around.
One of them, exhausted from 30 hours of continuous duty, was drinking coffee when he tripped on the stone steps and spilled the cup. Grumbling, he crushed the plastic foam in his hand, stuffed it in his pocket, and told his lapel-mounted radio microphone that everything was clear at his post. The coffee froze almost instantly on the shaded granite. Inside the cathedral, yet another team of agents checked out every shadowed nook one more time before taking their places, allowing protocol officers to make final preparations, referring to seating instructions faxed to them only minutes before, and wondering what would go wrong. The gun carriages came to a halt in front of the building, and the cars came up one at a time to discharge their passengers. Ryan got out, followed by his family, moving to join the Durlings. The kids were still in shock, and maybe that was good, or maybe it was not. Jack didn't know. At times like this, what did a man do? He placed his hand on the son's shoulder while the cars came, dropped off their passengers, and pulled rapidly away. The other official mourners, the senior ones, would form up behind him. Less senior ones would be entering the church now from side entrances, passing through portable metal detectors, while the churchmen and choir, having already done the same, would be taking their places. Roger must have remembered his service in the 82nd with pride, Jack thought. The soldiers who'd led the procession stacked arms and prepared to do their duty under the supervision of a young captain, assisted by two serious-looking sergeants. They all looked so young, even the sergeants, all with their heads shaved nearly down to stubble under their berets. Then he remembered that his father had served in the rival 101st Airborne more than 50 years before, and had looked just like these kids, though probably with a little more hair, since the bald look hadn't been fashionable in the 1940s. But the same toughness, the same fierce pride, and the same determination to get the job done, whatever it might be. It seemed to take forever. Ryan, like the soldiers, couldn't turn his head. He had to stand at attention as he'd done during his own service in the Marine Corps, though allowing his eyes to scan around. His children turned their heads and shifted on their feet with the cold, while Kathy kept her eyes on them, worrying, as her husband did, about the exposure to the cold, but caught in a situation where even parental concerns were subordinated to something else. What was it, she wondered, this thing called duty, that even orphaned children knew that they had to stand there and just take it? Finally, the last of the official procession alighted from their cars and took their places. Someone gave it a 5-count, and the soldiers moved to the gun carriages, 7 to each. The officer in charge of them unscrewed one clamp, then the other, and the caskets were lifted and moved off in robotic sidesteps. The soldier holding the presidential flag started up the steps, followed by the caskets. The president's was in front, led by the captain and followed by the sergeant in charge of the sub-detail. It wasn't anybody's fault. There were 3 soldiers on either side, marching to the slow cadence called by the sergeant. They were stiff from standing 15 minutes at parade rest after a healthy morning walk up Massachusetts Avenue. The middle one on the right slipped on the frozen coffee just as all were taking a step. He slid inward, not outward, and in going down his leg swept away the soldier behind him. The total load was over 400 pounds of wood, metal, and body, and it all came down on the soldier who'd been first to slip, breaking both his legs in an instant on the granite steps. A collective gasp came up from the thousands of people watching. Secret Service agents rushed in, fearing that a shot might have felled the soldiers. Andrea Price moved in front of Ryan, her hand inside her coat, and obviously holding her service automatic, ready to draw it out, while other agents poised to drag the Ryans and the Durlings clear of the area. The soldiers were already moving the casket off their fallen comrade, his face suddenly white with pain.
"Ice," he told the sergeant through clenched teeth. "Slipped."
The soldier even had enough self-control to refrain from the profanity that echoed through his mind at the shame and embarrassment of the moment. An agent looked at the step and saw it there,
a white-brown mound that reflected light. He made a gesture that told Price she could stand down, which command was instantly radioed out to all the agents in sight. Just a slip, just a slip.